My name's Paul Bestall. This is Mysteries and Monsters on the Paranormal UK Radio Network. Welcome to this week's Mysteries and Monsters. Well, I hoped you enjoyed our Halloween double episode special, and thank you for your positive comments about both of our guests. This week, we tackle a subject we've never covered before, alien abduction. Anyone who is into ufology knows of plenty of these alleged abductee cases, but some are still discussed and viewed as more compelling than others. We have the Betty and Barney Hill case, Travis Walton's story, Whitley Strieber's Communion books, which terrified me as a teenager, and over here in the UK, with the compelling Alan Godfrey incident as well. One case, however, seems to have been re-evaluated, thanks in part to the legendary UK ufologist Philip Mantle, the 1973 abduction of two men in Mississippi. Philip has dragged the Pascagoula case back to the forefront of the subject and has been responsible for convincing Calvin Parker to finally tell of his experience after 45 years of silence. I'm delighted to have Calvin on this week's show, and I hope you find his story as compelling and frightening as I do. Before we join him, don't forget you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. You can also support us on Patreon for $1 a month. And don't forget to subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. Now, let's join Calvin Parker. My guest today is synonymous with just one word, and that word is Pascagoula. Back in 1973, Calvin Parker had an incident that changed his life. And I am delighted to say that Calvin is here to talk to us today about his new book and his life since that evening on October the 11th. 1973. Calvin, thank you for joining me today, sir.
Thank you for having me. I've been looking forward to this all week. You know, I'm almost starting to feel like I'm family over in the UK there.
Well, yeah, it's been very interesting, obviously, being based in the UK, that it seems like your story kind of regained popularity through the UK first and then went back to the States. Is that how it seemed to happen for you, Calvin?
That's exactly the way that it is. I know I wasn't even interested in doing the first book at all. And then Philip Mantle contacted me, and I had been having trouble with the press changing little words that you say and big words that you say. Philip says, look, why don't you make your legacy, write you a book, document it, put it black and white, and they can't change nothing. So I agreed on that. It made a lot of sense to me. And Philip has been a lovely person. I mean, we've become real good friends over the past. I have a lot of trust in Philip. I put it like that.
So how did it all come back around for you, Calvin? Because with the greatest respect, you've been quite well known for just basically not wanting to talk about this story until fairly recently. And we'll discuss the reasons for that. And reading your story and diving into it, I don't blame you, to be honest. But was it just a case of you just felt that it was time to get it off your chest for your sakes more than anybody else's?
Well, what had happened, we had a neighbor pass away. My wife and I went to a funeral, And when we was at the funeral, I didn't realize that people down here on the coast was hungry to hear about this. I figured everybody would blow it away. And they all started coming up, and I signed a register, and they all came up and started wanting to talk about it. So out of respect for this man's family, I told my wife, I said, you know, we need to go. We don't need to be disrespectful to him and his children. And on the way home, she mentioned, well, maybe you ought to write a book. People are really wanting to hear from you. And I just put her off. I said, well, you know, I don't have any kind of education at all. Sure, not no writer, and I'm not. I said, so let me think about it. I was doing that just to put my wife off. Well, by chance, the next day, Philip Mantle called. Just out of the blue, he had gotten a hold of me through Martin Willis. They had a little podcast show going on that I was on a few years ago, just because I knew Martin. And he brought up the same thing. I said, well, Philip, you know, the reason I don't is the news media, because they take something that's already big and they change it into something bigger just to have their story. And I've hid from that all my life. I never talked to my wife, my family, my friends, nobody until July last year when this book came out. He said, well, let that be your legacy and do it. So I told Philip, putting him off now, I said, well, let me think about it a week or so. Well, when Philip tells you he's going to call you back in a week or so, he definitely means it. And I put no answer on my phone because I didn't want to hear nothing else about a book from him or my wife. I was at the boat landing, the phone rung, and I didn't look at the no answer on my caller ID, and I picked it up and answered it just so it would quit ringing, and it was Philip. Well, he got me to thinking again, well, this might be a good idea. So we reached the decision to do a book, and he's the first person I ever really talked to about any of this. And he says, well, you know, I know it might take you 2 or 3 years to do this. And I was thinking, shoot, I can read a book in 2 weeks easy, you know, even without much of an education. I can write this thing in a couple of weeks. So I told him, I said, Philip, under one condition, that I'll do this. I said, I don't want nothing changed in this book. I'm an old South Mississippi redneck. I just shoot it straight down the line the way that it is. I don't want a misspell word corrected. I don't want a punctuation mark put in anywhere. I want the book as is. And I was thinking, you know, if it don't come out like that, I would just, you know, wipe it off the map. There won't be nothing to it. So I locked myself in my bedroom a couple of weeks. I had my little part of it done. And Philip, he sent me back a little email, and he said, that's quite a mess right there.
Thanks, Philip.
Yeah, I appreciate you, Philip. It might be quite a mess, but it's my mess. So he got to give me a little guideline to go by, and I went by that guideline. Well, sure enough, come the first book, and I liked it. It was in my words. And I've had people say, well, look, you know, it's not in book form, but it's like sitting in the living room and talking to you and you telling a story. Well, that's what I wanted. You know, I wanted everybody just to be eyes. Well, I never really figured the book would sell. I figured I might sell 10 copies and I'd have to buy all 10 of them and hand out to my family because I wasn't still about to sit down and tell this story a bunch of different times to family. So I ordered a few and I handed out and I set my wife down and I told her the whole story because in 45 years I've never talked to her or my daughter about this, about what had happened. But they knew it, but I never talked about it because I figured people would think I was crazy.
Yeah.
So I sat down and I told them the story. Well, the next thing I knew, the book hit the bestsellers list. Apparently, everybody wanted to hear the story.
Hmm.
And it just kept going from there, from there, from there. And then this July, Philip says, well, we need to add a little something to the book, you know, what all's happened.
Yeah.
But it got to be so much that it, and it wouldn't be fair to put it in that book and everybody else had done bought one. So he just did another book on it. And I enjoyed the second book, the Pastor Gula, the new, the story continues, new evidence and new witnesses. Now I've sat down and I've read that through and through myself just in case I might have missed something.
Yeah.
But this book has actually been a lot of fun. I've enjoyed it. And I believe it's better, a lot better than the first book, because I've learned things out of this book that I didn't know. And I've got to meet a lot of people. And I've got to go to a lot of conferences and talk to people. And I do, you know, quite a few little podcasts and radio shows. And mm-hmm. I was just on with George Knapp. Most everybody knows him last night.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's been fun. It's been a new experience to me. Kind of down in my health a little bit right now. Nothing that I can think of real major, you know. Mm. We all got expiration dates stamped on our head.
Yeah.
And I just accept it the way that things are. So I might have to slow down a little bit on my traveling this year. But I really don't want to. I really want to go and make a few of these conferences because I've met some great people.
Yeah. I mean that's, I suppose, one of the exciting things about what's happened, because, like you say, Calvin, it's probably been a whirlwind 18 months since the first book's released to obviously the new book came out on the 1st of October last week. I suppose, has the positive reaction to it all made you kind of think, I wish I'd done this 10 years ago?
Well, no, actually, 10 years ago, I had a stroke, you know, and I had to pretty much, I was bedridden there for a while, but I've managed to get up and go. Yeah. And then I had two open heart surgeries. So now I have a little time on my hands, and I'm able to go to these places and kind of promote this book a little bit. And it's been great for me and my wife, too. You know, if you go 45 years and not really tell a woman everything she wants to know, it kind of upsets them a little bit.
Yeah, so, I can imagine.
Yeah. So this has opened up some new doors for us. And in order to keep her involved in this, when I go to the conferences, I'll buy her plane ticket. She'll go with me. Mm-hmm. And she gets to get out and meet the people that I know and that I've just become to know and became to like.
Yeah.
And I was so disappointed because I didn't get to come to the UK where all y'all were. I was so much planning on that. But, you know, health conditions, I couldn't do it. Yeah. But...
Well, you've got to accept yourself first, Calvin. I mean, that's the key thing here. I mean, it was a shame. And, you know, like I say, as someone that was attending that conference, I mean, I was going for a couple of reasons, you being one of them, of course, but at the end of the day, your health and your, you know, your family come before anything, my friend.
Yeah, and you know, without your health, you can't go to any of them.
No, true.
We just made that one in Phoenix. That was pretty much my last conference for the year.
Mm.
And well, I had to put one more off in Missouri or somewhere. But anyhow, we just made that conference in Phoenix. We had a blast there. I mean, it was fun. The people were so friendly. And then we went to the mountains. We drove down there just to see the scenery.
Hmm.
Then we went to Las Vegas and Laughlin, Nevada. Then I was in McAllen, Texas. And everywhere I go, I meet the greatest people in the world. I mean, I never figured people that seen UFOs and aliens would be this nice. They are good. And So I don't regret none of this at all. And now I don't regret doing this, because back when all this happened, there was no social media. And you couldn't get on there and talk to the people like you can now. You know, you'd have to sit there and write a letter. And it's just no way to keep all that up. And poor old Charlie Hickson, you know, he broke out of the gates running with this thing. And I never understood that. The man just gave up his whole life to go on this book and all. And, you know, I didn't want to do that.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things, Calvin. I think having... because with the greatest respect, you're the second person I've ever met with a story of a similar nature. For me, I've always found it a very interesting subject, primarily because the fact that you sat on it and just didn't want to buy into the circus that broke out around the story, because obviously in the book there's some fabulous old newspaper cuttings, and you know, there's a history of articles and little bits that have been on shows over the years about it. I would imagine for a young man from Mississippi, Calvin, this was just something that you were not prepared for under any circumstances.
Absolutely not. I had my life planned when this happened. You know, I was going to become a preacher. And I felt real strong about that. My religion still feels strong about it.
Yeah.
And all I wanted to do was get married, buy a house, have children, retire, and fish.
Yeah.
Pretty much in that order. Mm. And, you know, this changed my whole life. I moved from place to place. I've always made good money. I left, when I left Pascagoula, I went to work in the oil field again.
Mm.
And I just followed it around, and I bought my own construction company and pipeline for a while, up until I had a heart attack and stroke. So, you know, I've just been around pretty much, meeting a lot of people. I've always been a people person, but when this happened, I drew back from people. I lived here since before Katrina. That was in 2005 in the same subdivision. Now, up until this book came out, nobody even knew who I was here. They didn't even know my real name. I just didn't get out and meet people. Didn't want to get out and meet no people. And now you walk out the door, you never know who's parked in your driveway. Everybody in Pascagoula knows me. And it's been accepted so well down here. The first book signing Rebecca Davis had for Pascagoula, and asked me to come down last October the 11th. I was shocked. I didn't realize that anybody, like I say, would much less even want to buy a book, but much less even want to come meet me. And when we got there, they had the streets, had to shut all the streets down because of the crowd, the people that was there. And they lined up going to get books and bring them up so I'd autograph them and just talk to them. Well, it just overwhelmed me. I mean, it was miles of people stretched out back there. And I didn't realize there was that much interest in it. And that's one thing that kind of started some of these witnesses come forward. They said, you know, if a little uneducated redneck can go out and do this, then, you know, we don't mind telling our story.
Yeah. I mean, for many people, I think it's one of those things. So without wishing to, you know, tread over a very well-trodden path, Calvin, let's go back to that night on the 11th of October. I mean, it's almost exactly 46 years ago, strangely enough.
Yeah.
Which is one of the things that struck me when I was obviously pre-reading the book. In regards to chatting to you, there was a couple of little things that made me go, "Oh, that's quite weird." Because, but I'll get to that later on. So, this particular night, I think, if I'm correct, you'd only just started working with Charlie, hadn't you?
Yeah, this was October the 11th, and I came down October the 10th and took my physical and done my paperwork so I could go to work with October the 11th. I was working in the oil field, and it was 16 hours a day, 7 days a week. I was making bukus of money, but I wanted fixing to get married that fall on November the 9th, and I wanted a different job, so I came down and called Charlie, come down and went to work for him. And then during the day that this all happened, we had worked all day long and got off work. And Charles asked me if I wanted to go fishing. I said, of course, I'd love to go fishing, but I got a problem. I didn't bring none of my fishing equipment. He said, well, I got some. We'll run by the house and pick it up and you can use mine. Now, for a man from the South to loan you his fishing equipment, that's like you getting his firstborn. I mean, that's just serious.
Yeah, special.
Or it is. So we ran by and picked up the fishing equipment and went to one site. The bugs were so bad, so we left and went over to the Shaw Peters Shipyard, which was an abandoned shipyard. And we got out of the car, and I looked. What a mess all of it was. You know, it had been shut down for a while. We walked down to the pier, drug up an old log, and was just sitting there. And I remember looking out across that pier to a old steel hull ship. Now, the reason I was thinking about this is working in the shipyard and looking how thick and heavy the steel was and wondering, now, how does something made out of steel float? And that's when I noticed, reflecting from my back, some blue hazy lights.
Yeah.
Now, them lights are the same color as the police lights were down here. So I thought we was in a private property on an abandoned shipyard with no trespassing signs. I was thinking, well, we're going to jail.
Yeah.
Because that's the police. So I stood up and turned around, and Charlie did about the same time. And that's when the light just got awful bright. I mean, just blinding bright. And what I figured, that's when they opened the door and they hit us with a spotlight when they did that, or some kind of lights. And when it got to where we could see a little bit, I noticed there was three robotic-looking creatures approaching us. And I say robotic because that's the way that they moved. You know, they didn't, it's not like they had a brain and they was thinking, you know, it just moved mechanical looking. Well, two of them got a hold of Charlie and one of them got a hold of myself. And I felt an injection in my arm. And I think, oh, that's where Philip, you know, come up with the medical information from the doctors and the hospitals and all.
Yeah.
About to punch a wound mark in my arm. They injected something in me that took the fear out, but it kind of paralyzed me also. Now I could move my head and I could move my eyes and I could still smell a bad smell around, because the Mississippi Gulf Coast don't smell good at all. You know, you got them pogey plants and everything cooking, and so everybody asked me, well, did you smell something? I said, yeah, everything normal, a bunch of dead fish.
Yeah.
So anyhow, they took us, this one floated me up to the craft. And I remember when we got to the door looking in there to see where that light was coming from. And it looked just like the light was coming out of the walls, just illuminating out of the paint in the walls. So he made this big ugly one that I call him, kind of made a left turn. Then we went in and made a little right turn, and there was an examination table there laying on about a 45 to a 16 degree angle, somewhere in that range. And he laid me on this table. And then out of the ceiling come what I call, looked like a deck of cards. And it came down and it stopped about a foot, maybe a foot and a half from my forehead. And it started revolving around my head, but it would click as it would go around. And then It was shot back up into the ceiling. Now, I was still laying there, all, you know, afraid, and I guess afraid is a good word, and wishing I hadn't even could have got out of coming in there. And I noticed from the corner of my eyes a little bit of movement. And that's when what I called the female came over and approached me. And she looked just like a average, you know, human in a way, except a little skinnier than anything. She had regular eyes, had regular mouth, regular nose. The only difference I could see in her hands were the other creature, the big ugly one, had all looked like mittens on her. I call them crab-like hands. She had normal-looking hands, except her two middle fingers was a little bit longer. She come out, and I don't know if it was a she or not. I'm just assuming it was. I just had that sense that it was. And grabbed me by the cheek and kind of rubbed it. I didn't feel any sensation there at all. No warmth. I just felt her grab hold of my cheek. Then she took her other hand and she pushed down on my chin and opened my mouth. And there's nothing I could do about it. I just had to lay there and take it.
Yeah.
And she run her fingers, two fingers off her other hand, middle fingers, down my throat. And that little thing that hangs down back there, I don't know what they call it,
yeah,
the medical term, but it's a little hang-me-down thing. She tried to come up behind it. Well, I started choking, and my nose started bleeding and all real bad. Well, she pulled her hand out, and telepathically, she said, and this is what got me. It was in a southern redneck female voice, and I know they had to practice that or something to put everybody at ease. She says, "We're not going to harm you." Now, this is just mentally, but it sounded just like her talking. I didn't see no lips moving.
Yeah.
And she backed up out of the way and made a little grumbling noise out of her throat. And this big, ugly one just popped up like a spring, like a jack-in-the-box, and came back over there and grabbed me by the arm again. And I felt, heard a little puff of air, and I felt a little bit of pain real quick, like, in my left arm again, which that was a second injection I got that night. And this thing, when it was through, I had blood all over my shirt, my face, and my nose was bleeding. He floated me back out to the river and set me down on the riverbank facing the rivers with my arms outstretched. And that was, this is the first time I heard the guy's voice that was with me. Charlie said, "Calvin, Calvin, you okay, son?" And I was thinking, "Well, you idiot. No, I'm not okay. You know, I got made to go on a spaceship. Some alien woman had put her finger down my throat, playing 50 Shades of Grey or whatever she did." I said, "No, I'm not okay." And then we turned around and looked. And by that time, this thing lifted up off the ground, just shot straight up into the air like a streak of lightning and was gone. And that was the first time. Then in 93, I kind of went through another little deal again. But that got it all kind of started there. From there, you know, we went to the hospital and got a checkup. We went to the sheriff department, or the sheriff department came to us, give us a sobriety test. Then they made me blow in one of them balloons to see if I'd been drinking. And, of course, all that showed up negative. But while we was at the sheriff's department, they split us up and interrogated us separate. Then they put us in a room together. But little did we know there was a tape recorder in this room. And we started talking about this incident, because I kept telling Charlie, "Let's not tell nobody, let's not tell nobody." But Charlie was the big gossip, I guess. And, you know, he made the phone call to Keesler, and he made the phone call to the sheriff department. Because back in, we had to go to a payphone. There wasn't no such thing as cell phones.
Yeah.
Or I guess it was, but you couldn't afford one.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that's always been quite striking about that evening, Calvin, is as you refer to when you first see the lights, the first thing that comes into your head is that it's the police because you're fishing on private property. You're trespassing.
Exactly.
So for you to then go through such a situation that a couple of hours later on, you're going to the police station to basically say, this incredible thing's happened to us whilst we were breaking the law, which I think is what a lot of people forget about
Oh,
the
yeah.
evening, is that, at the end of the day, you'd still gone to the police. They could have just done you for that, because you basically admitted we were trespassing and then this has happened. But then they also left that tape running that you two were not aware of. Essentially, in the hope of tripping you up and catching you out, really, weren't they?
Exactly. But it kind of backfired on him. The
Yes.
sheriff at that time, he was hard-nosed sheriff now. And he would have locked us up in a minute for anything that we did wrong. And for him to come out and say, of course, he had this, what I call the secret tape. And I didn't even know about the secret tape for a pretty good while. But he came out and admitted, and I think Andrew Hoffman's got that recorded where he gave a press release the next day. He said, I don't know what happened to these guys. But something happened to him. They were scared to death, especially the younger one. And he was right, I was. And I was scared enough. And like I say, I was a Christian. I was wanting to be a preacher. Now, the church and aliens don't mix just real well, not especially back in. They might do a little better now. So I knew my career would be gone that I had planned on and worked on. And I figured my marriage would be gone because my wife's daddy back in, she was 16 years old. I was 18, 19. He was a hard nose. And if he had heard about something like this, of course, and he did, but he never questioned me about it. The only thing the man ever said was, after this happened, I don't believe you. But then, he came back in a few months. He said, I got to apologize to you because I believe you. I know that happened because I got some catfish ponds and something was over there and it was pulling the water out of the ponds and the water rolled over and it killed all my fish and I seen it. So for him to come back and apologize and say that, I mean, it was something else.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is. I mean, that's a crucial aspect of this as well. And I think, as we've touched on earlier, Calvin, it's probably one of the key reasons why you suppressed it and bottled it up, was because you knew the ramifications of coming out with a story like this, and what going public would do to you, both personally and professionally.
Exactly. And a guy, especially somebody like me, young, didn't have a big work history. I mean, I had one, but it wasn't nothing on paper. And you just didn't want to do that. Fixing to get married, got a new wife or girlfriend, and we was engaged. And my family, they was hard against anything out of the ordinary. And I mean, it would have been really hard to come forward. Now, I always questioned Charlie why he took the other road because we agreed that night that we wasn't going to tell nobody. And the first thing he did was call Keesler Air Force Base. He said, pull over this phone and stop. I need to make some calls. And I thought he was calling home, but he called Keesler Air Force Base, then he called the Sheriff Department. So he had to take this as hard as what I did for in order for him to call too, because he also had a life and a family life, and I know it was hard on him to accept this also.
Yeah, absolutely. And he was a vet as well, wasn't he? Didn't he? Hadn't he served in the U.S. Army and gone to and fought in the Korean War?
Korean War, yeah. He was at North Korea over there. And, he was pretty much, he could have been a hard nose about all this and all. But it upset Charlie, and not too many things upsets him. And the way we proved we wasn't drinking, we took her sobriety test and everything. We took her blood alcohol test. We got her physicals at Jackson County Singing River Hospital. And the thing I hate is all the paperwork and the blood work and all come up in the storm, got underwater, and they didn't back things up back in on computers. It was all hard copies, and they was transferring this stuff over. So we lost a lot of valuable information there, such as what was in our blood. Now, the doctor that examined us is still alive, Dr. Bosco, and I seen his grandson. Dr. Bosco's 99 years old, and I seen his grandson not too long ago, and he said he wants to talk to you. And I have got to get over there and talk to him and see if he remembers anything at all. But it's been a long, hard journey. So when all these other witnesses started coming forward, that really made me feel good.
Yeah, I mean it's interesting as well because obviously, probably until the last sort of couple of years, Calvin, I think the only real witness that had validated yours and Charlie's story was a gentleman called Emmanuel Cigalas. And I think he was driving a car and he claimed to have seen an object, him and his passenger, or he was the passenger. They were the only real people that had come forward, and then it's like we've touched on, once you kind of said, I've had enough of sitting on this, my family deserve to know the truth, and I think for you as well, Calvin, you deserve to let this out because holding something like this in for so long can't be healthy. Really,
You
my
know,
friend.
it's been a hard pill for me to swallow because I felt like I couldn't talk to nobody about it. I guess Philip Mantle was the first one I've talked to about it. And I know what these other witnesses supposedly was going through. And somebody said, well, they just wanted the 30 minutes or 5 minutes of fame. That ain't true. The first one that came forward, it was just a big mistake. I did a had an interviewer come out with Fox News, and we was on Fox News, and her daughter had made a comment in the bottom. You know how people can comment at the bottom of something, and her name was Trace Blair, and she said, "My mother seen this and has always wanted to talk to Calvin Parker," and that's all she said. Well, Phillip's like a bloodhound. He read that. And he started hunting who this person was. Well, it took quite a while. And so Maria, everybody said she just wanted to come out. Maria didn't come out toward us. We approached Maria. And eventually, under pressure a little bit, she has, told her story. And I mean, no pressure from Phillip and I, but, just from hunting her down. And she said, well, if you can tell what happened, I can too. Well, it hadn't been long. Her husband was in the hospital, and the outcome didn't look real good for him. And he had always said, people think you're crazy, Maria, if you tell anybody. Well, pretty much, when he was in the hospital, he told him to get the camera out. His daughter to get her phone out and tape this. Well, he admitted that he seen the same thing Maria seen and told his story right there. Then he said at the end, this is all I'm going to say about it. This is the last time I'm going to mention it. Well, the man really wasn't expecting to live right then or come out of the hospital. So I call that a deathbed confession. Ain't nobody going to tell no story on their deathbed. I wouldn't.
You wouldn't waste precious time, Calvin,
No.
constructing some kind of made-up story for no reason whatsoever. You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters on the Paranormal UK Radio Network.
Absolutely. And, you know, if anything, I would want to visit with my family and do all that. But I wouldn't be talking about something that I thought was a spaceship or an alien.
Hmm.
Now, somebody asked me one time before 73, have you ever heard anything like it? Now, look, I was a country boy way out in the country. We sharecropped until I went in the oil field. But I walked behind a mule for 200 or 300 acres of land, you know, plowing it for cotton and all. We didn't have time to watch no TV. And you had three stations on TV. That was CBS, NBC, and ABC. And unless something major was going on, and the only thing that I could relate to that come out of the heavens, you know, was the Apollo space mission.
Hmm.
And I remember watching that on TV. Everybody would group up around it. Some of them be downtown in these department stores looking in the windows at the TVs.
Yes.
And they quarantined these astronauts from their families for 7 days before they would even let their families see them. Well, that's one reason we went to the hospital. I was concerned about giving somebody some kind of bacteria or radiation or something.
Yeah.
And the only reason I could think of radiation, because my father worked for the Atomic Energy Commission when they was exploding them bombs out at Groom Lake.
Mm.
Over trying to experiment with them, you know, underground nuclear bombs. So, you know, all this was a concern, and that was another thing that brought it out.
Yeah.
But
I mean, sorry, go on, Calvin.
No, that's fine. I just didn't want nobody to get nothing that I had that would hurt them.
Absolutely. I mean, it is something that I've always found perplexing as well when dealing with skeptical responses to stories such as yours, Calvin. One of the explain all solutions that they put forward is often that popular cultures influence this person. You know, they've spent their life watching B movies and hanging around drive-ins and I think sometimes that they just don't expect people to check what television and cinema was like in those particular areas. And you've explained it there perfectly, Calvin. You had three channels. You didn't have time to go to the drive-in. You weren't hanging around. You know, you didn't have video stores. These films were not on all the time. I find it implausible that every time there's a situation like this, Calvin, they say, oh, well, he'd seen too many science fiction films as a kid.
Yeah, well, that's kind of like the guy with the Rolling Stones magazine wanted to interview. Well, he was, you know, young guy, and he called up. And I told him, yeah. And he says, well, they didn't say nothing about the cameras and them shipyards picking you up. And I don't know why. Normally I hold my temper with something like that. But that's like I said, well, you idiot, this shipyard was abandoned. It didn't have no electricity, and they weren't cameras back in everywhere like it is now. But, you know, they try to make something that's not there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like you've just said, I mean, obviously the reason you'd gone and spoken to Charlie and got this job was that, you know, you were basically flogging yourself to death. You know,
right.
Working 7 days a week, 16 hours a day. I think the only two things you were probably doing at that time, Calvin, was eating, sleeping, and working. That was it. You know?
Well, that's true. And where we was working was 100 miles from the house. So we carpooled. One would drive one day, and another would drive the next.
Mm.
But it was five of us, and we'd drive 100 miles to work and 100 miles back, which was about an hour and a half for each way. Then you put in 16 hours a day. You're pretty tired the time you get home. You sleep mostly in the car.
I mean, it's an incredible, demand on even somebody at your age at that time, Calvin, because we all think we're indestructible when we're teenagers. I remember
Oh, yeah.
it
And then when you get up, I'll be 65 next November, and I just feel the golden years tearing me apart.
well.
It's a shame the way life ought to be. You ought to retire when you're a teenager and then work when you get older, wore out.
Yeah, enjoy it while you can recover, Calvin.
There you go.
I think that's a very
Oh.
good philosophy to have, my friend.
Oh God, these golden years are rough, I'm telling you.
Oh, well.
Everything that can break down has broke down on me.
Excellent. Well, thank you for selling
Yeah.
that me. Thank you.
It just gets worse, I think.
So, I mean, it's always, like I say, I've always found it an incredibly fascinating story. There are several stories in the history of ufology that are of a similar nature as yours, Calvin, obviously. And I noticed in the book you'd bumped into one of them, which was Travis Walton. And I've always found his story an incredible one as well. So,
Well,
how have you found this as you've gone on to the circuit and been to these conventions, Calvin? How have you found meeting people who have had a very, not exactly the same, because obviously yours is quite different in the fact that it was rather it's rather violent, in essence. How's
oh yeah.
that been?
Well, you know what? Everybody. Now, since the book's come out, they want to talk to me and meet me now. And that's such an honor and pleasure to talk to some of these people. And for instance, I know after this happened, I was hunting answers, like I'm still hunting answers. And that's a lot of the reason here. And I got an opportunity to go up and spend some time with Betty Hill. And, Betty and Barney's abduction happened in the 60s, and I said, well, if any, and at that time, we was right, Charlie and I was right behind him. I said, if anybody knows how to deal with it, she will. And I said, now why do I believe her? Well, I knew this happened to me. And then I got to thinking, this is the 60s. Betty Hill was a white woman married to a black man. Now, I'm not racist, but a lot of people back then, they wouldn't want this on their case. They wouldn't want anybody just know about it, because they would hang them back in for doing stuff like that. And if she was willing and he was willing to put it all out there, and them being a mixed marriage in the 60s, then they had to be telling the truth, the way I thought. And the way I think, I try to think in reasons. So I spent some time with her just to help deal with this. Nah, it really didn't help deal with it, but she had a good, interesting story, the same as Travis Walton and all.
I mean, like you say, I mean, that is an excellent point, which I think is often overlooked in the Betty and Barney Hill story, is that they were a mixed race couple, which at the time was, it was, in certain states, and let's not drag over, that period of the past, because I don't think it reflects well on anyone, to be honest.
Absolutely not.
It was an extremely brave thing for them to do, really was. And like you've touched on, it just isn't considered. I think in this day and age, we don't think anything of it, Calvin. It's, it's drop of a hat,
Oh yeah.
But
We
go on, sorry.
right here where I live, in my same subdivision, we have some mixed marriages. Nobody thinks nothing about it anymore. But back in, it would have got you out of Oak Tree.
Yeah, if you picked the wrong place, you were in big trouble, sadly.
Exactly. But that's the way I look at things. I don't look at through an educated eye at anything, because education is a great thing for a lot of people. But hard work has always been my thing, so I try to take the common sense thing, and that's why I thought of something like that. Now, Why would they put themselves out there for something like that? And I look at all of it, and that's why I said, why would I put myself out there, be fixing to get married, young at the job market? There ain't nobody going to hire you. They do, they're going to laugh at you. So that's why I've kept my identity under a hat all this time.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of humility in how you've been, Calvin, because I think one of the key aspects for you, and you've mentioned it a couple of times, was you were worried about how your wife-to-be and her family would take this, the ramifications of what you could possibly say, what it would do to them.
Exactly right. And, it just caused some tension between me and her because I never would talk about this until this book came out. And then, if I talked to everybody else, I had to open up to her first. Mm-hmm. And it's helped my marriage. I have to say, I've got a great marriage. We take vacations together now. We laugh. We cut up. And you do see some great people at some of these conferences. But then there's some people that's a little too far out there even for me. And, we get to meet them. But when we go to a conference, we don't just go down and I give my little spiel and go back up to the room. I want to meet the people. The reason for these books to me, I'm looking for answers before I die. And the only way you're going to find answers is talk to people, get to meet different people, and go where this subject is. Because one day, it's going to hit. Somebody's going to say something, and there's a light going to go off. Mm. And that'll be my answer.
Yeah. I mean, at the time when it happened, though, you were sort of UFO royalty for a little while, because you did have some of, the biggest ufologists and investigators at the time come and try and help out, really, didn't you? Which is quite remarkable.
Well, that's like Dr. Hynek that was over Project Blue Book. The next morning, I did a show with his son, with George Knapp, last night.
Yeah.
And I asked his son, I said, now look, this happened about 11 o'clock, I guess, about when the news broke at night. Mm. That man was down here at 6 o'clock the next morning. How did he do that? And, back in, that was unheard of, getting out and catching a plane, getting here that quick.
Yeah.
He said, well, I don't know unless he was working in the area. But I become real close to his son. Matter of fact, I've stayed in touch. I had Dr. Hynek's personal phone number, and I'd call, and I remember Paul answering the phone, and that whole family's geniuses. I mean, entertainment for them kids, when they was coming up, they got out and built a jet motor in the backyard.
Yeah.
And that was just kind of entertainment. But yeah, I've had Dr. Stant Freeman, Bud Hopkins, some of the best, and passing it on. Philip Mantle, I consider him a great ufologist, or whatever they call him.
Yeah.
So, I enjoy talking, because, like I say, one day somebody's gonna hand me the answer in a platter, I guess, or I'm hoping.
Well, I think that's all we can do, Calvin, is to keep searching for the answers to questions, because I think when we stop looking for answers, it seems pointless carrying on with anything.
You're exactly right. And I'll look for them until I find them, or maybe somebody else will. I mean, there's two things, really, I want to do before I die. I used to be an Elvis impersonator for entertainment, yeah. And one day I want to get back up on the stage and do some of his songs again. And I'm pretty dang good at them. And if I keep my health, next year at one of these conferences, I'm going to make them let me sing to them for a while.
Excellent. That'll be interesting, Calvin.
Oh, yeah. Travis Walton bought his guitar to the last one we set up on the, on a little stage up there and listen to him sing for a little while.
Yeah. Well, there's a duet that would be that sell tickets, Calvin, I think.
Oh, yeah. Maybe me and him ought to start a sideshow.
It could be a new offshoot for it, Abductee Rock Band, or do a bit of a rock and roll, my friend.
Exactly.
So, I mean, the other thing is obviously that there's a documentary on the way as well. About the case, which I was very privileged to see at the Outer Limits conference in August of this year. How was it getting involved in that, Calvin? Because I know I think prior to that, as far as I'm aware, you'd only briefly appeared on another documentary, which was called Into the Unknown, which was that made in the early 90s or something?
Yeah, I don't even remember that one.
Yeah, because you're not on it for long. You're on it for about 30, you know, it's your story and you're not in it at all.
Well, and they probably, I've seen a lot of shows that I've been injected into where I didn't know I was into them.
Yeah.
And that's been the case through the years and all. I was telling Philip, you know, the other night, and the true story, I actually got a screened-in back porch, and I go out there and sit with a little dog sometime about 2 or 3 in the morning, just where it's quiet and peaceful and look. I went out there and said, it stays dark. I never turned the light on. And I heard somebody snoring. And I looked and scared the daylights out of me. I turned around and looked. And there was somebody asleep on my swing out there in the back. And I woke him up. And I was fixing to get all over him. And he said, please don't. I just want to talk to you, Mr. Parker. But this kind of thing happens a lot, you know. Not necessarily somebody sleeping on my swing.
Well, yeah.
But people pulling up unannounced in the driveway. Yeah. And this happens a lot, but I always take time to visit and see what this person's story is. Because you never know where they're coming from. Yeah. And this bothers some people, and they just want to talk about it. Yeah. Then I had a man come down and... He asked me if he was going to hell. I said, you know, man, I don't know. I don't know what you've done in your life. That's between you and God. It's nothing to do with me.
Yeah. Have you had other abductees approach you then, Calvin, to kind of talk to you about their experience because they now think that you're not a shoulder to cry on, but a sympathetic ear?
Absolutely. And, 99% of them is really believable. But then you still have that other 1% out there that gives me the eebie-jeebies and all, you know, where, you know, even me going through this, it put a doubt in my mind that just a hard pill to swallow sometimes.
It is. It is when you think that overwhelmingly, though, it's been a very positive experience for you and your family. I know there's a bit that you refer to in the book where you say you think it's brought your family closer together, coming out with all this.
It has. I found out things since I've done the book and since they've known me that, you know, I didn't know about my family. I don't get in nobody's business usually. And, never did want nobody in mine. I got a neighbor that tries to stay in my business or did for a while, and I finally had to almost evict him down there.
Yeah. Well, he's probably after a cut.
Yeah, he might be.
I mean, the remarkable thing about the documentary when I saw it, and I'm really looking forward to watching it again, is the fact that it refers to the fact that you had a second experience when you went on another fishing trip in 1993. And I think we touched on it briefly. So what on earth happened the second time, Calvin?
Well, the second time got really violent and physical. You know, this was 20 years later. I've had time to brew over it. I didn't realize this was going to happen. And pretty much the same thing, you know, they pulled me up. I had some missing time. And I got out fishing. I told my wife I'd be back before dark. So I left and I got out to where I was going. I was on the island about 11 o'clock. Hmm. And it was 3 o'clock the next morning before I got back to my truck. Well, this bothered me where that missing time went. And actually, Bud Hopkins is the one that pulled this out through a hypnosis session. And I never believed in hypnosis, never thought I could be hypnotized. But he did. And I didn't realize it until the book came out. And I had mentioned to Philip that Bud had that, and he got the transcripts. And I didn't even know I'd been hypnotized. But this confrontation got so violent on there, because I was actually, it seemed like the same female and the same thing. Mm. And she had me against the wall trying to, and I'm thinking they might have been a transmitter or something that they had implanted in me. And she had me against the wall still trying to get her fingers down my throat. Well, I had enough. And I turned around and I beat her head against the wall and actually hurt her. And I was going to grab her around the neck. If I could have found a door, me and her both had been dead if we was up in the air, because I was going to bail out that door. But I meant she was going with me this time. Yeah. Everybody was going to see the physical evidence. But it's all in the new book now.
Yeah.
That whole transcript. And it goes into quite a bit of detail. What happened with Bud Hopkins' hypnosis, he run both these events into one. I had Kathleen Martin come out, and she rehypnotized me, a three-hour session. And she got them all separated into two different events. And it's a lot easier for people to read and understand.
Yeah. Oh, well, and obviously Kathleen is the niece of Betty and Barney, isn't she?
She is. And she's very intelligent. She's good at what she does. She even has a degree in forensics, and she can read body language. I mean, I was really impressed. And the only reason I agreed to let her do it, I met her at that conference in Arizona.
Hmm.
And we had a table set up, and she was next to mine. And we got to do a lot of talking, a lot of visiting. And I seen how smart she was and how serious she was about things. Hmm. And I said, well, you know, she would be the one if I'm ever going to be hypnotized again. And we went into a three-hour session there. And it got pretty intense in places.
Yeah. I mean, it's, as I touched on at the beginning, the thing that struck me about that was that that session actually happened on my birthday.
Oh, absolutely.
14th of September.
Is that right?
Yeah, which was very peculiar, because me and Stefanos, when we were talking about when he ended up, Stefanos Panagiotakis, when he ended up there and interviewed Charlie Hickson, we ended up talking about we'd visited the same island at the same time on several occasions, so we'd actually been within a couple of miles of each other, and never, obviously, hadn't realised we didn't have a relationship until this year.
Oh, shoot. Yeah, I was going to get to meet him when I came to the conference, but, you know, like I say, what happened, I just couldn't travel right then. I had a catheter in, and they had a bag strapped to my leg, and you don't want to get on an airplane and ride 15 hours without, or go to no conference and be around people.
Yeah.
So I stayed in the house for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Well, and part of getting old.
Well, yeah, and as we said earlier, health comes first, my friend. Health comes first. I mean, there is one other really interesting witness that I really found quite compelling in the new book, Calvin, and that's a guy called Clay Caldwell, who actually visited the site the day after, because I think he'd heard his parents working for the police or something like that, and he sneaked off to have a look at it.
Yeah, matter of fact, I think he was a dispatcher for the police department.
Mm.
And that night, they took about 50 calls in about the same thing. And he said that wasn't counting the walk-ins that came in. But he had to write a narrative on every call that came. And, you know, he said he was busy all night long writing narratives because the phone would keep ringing, somebody reporting UFOs and stuff. And, you know, the ironic thing about this, it came out in a newspaper in 18-something where just almost where this happened, they had spotted UFOs flying over this. Now, this was back in the 1800s, and it was 500 witnesses that seen this, and it was documented in the newspaper at the library, and I was trying to think of the name of it. But I actually got a copy of that. Same flight pattern.
Yeah. I mean, was it... I mean, that, for me, Calvin, says a lot as well. Was it frustration when you found out how many other people had seen something that night? Or did you just think, well, that clearly means I'm not alone?
Well, I thought, you know, that means I'm not alone. If maybe if they had a came forward before then, which I understand why they didn't, I might have come forward a little earlier.
Yeah.
I just didn't want to be the only one besides Charlie. You know, I figured it's bad enough thinking Charlie was an idiot coming out with it. Yeah. And the only reason I thought Charlie was crazy for coming out because of the time all this happened. I knew he had been abducted and all.
Mm.
But it was not a good time for him to come out, I wouldn't think. But again, if he hadn't have said something and came out of the closet, then I wouldn't be on this conversation today.
Mm. Very true. Very true. And I think, do you think, because obviously, you know, as you refer to there, Calvin, that the environment for talking about UFOs this right now in 2019 is probably the most sensible discussion we've had in normal media because of everything that's been going on over the last couple of years with the US Navy. So do you think it's perfect timing that you've come forward into the public and the other people, because of how things are now, feel more positive and more believed?
Oh, yeah. It's accepted now. We're back in. It wasn't accepted. I mean, I was just watching a little deal on the History Channel a while ago. And Ancient Aliens. And I flip over and watch it sometime. They got some pretty good stuff. Then they got some stuff where they inject their own ideals into it, and it gets way out there.
Yep. Very true. Very true. I mean, it is, for me, I think it's, as someone that was, I got really into ufology as a young man and found it really fascinating, and then kind of lost interest in it, Calvin. It all seemed to get a bit similar, and then over sort of the last 4 or 5 years, I've rediscovered a thirst for it, and I think I've probably come back to it at the right time because it just seems now that we can have these conversations without fear of ridicule and be treated in a far more respectful manner.
Oh yeah, it's pretty well accepted now.
Yeah.
And people kind of accept it like a religion now in a way.
Mm.
And when I say that, you know, they if you tell somebody you're Baptist or Jehovah Witness or something like that, well, they just say, well, he's Baptist or Jehovah Witness or Catholic. And you say you're into UFOs and all that, they say, well, that's good. He's just into that. You know, they don't hunt reasons to ridicule you anymore.
Very true. Very true. I mean, well, yes, because one of the other passages in the book that brings a smile to my lips whenever his name's mentioned is Philip Klass, who essentially just wanted to find out what he could discredit you and Charles about.
Yeah, and it didn't work real good for him. Philip did edit that a little bit, and I'm glad he did, because I don't want people to think of a violent nature. But he edited one thing out that I kind of said to him, and it was really nasty. That's what got us thrown out of the restaurant. But I just didn't like that man.
Yeah, well, he's. I think you're in good company in being insulted by him, Calvin, to be fair, because he said some nasty things about quite a lot of people over the years.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, it wasn't what he was saying about me so much.
Mm.
But we was in a restaurant eating, and, of course, they was going to buy our meals. I just rode up there with Charlie. And, buddy, he was all over Charlie. And for some reason, Charlie, you know, just kind of backing off and letting it ride.
Mm.
And I thought, well, you know, I was with Charlie. I'm not even going to take his.
Yeah.
And it almost got violent. It wouldn't have took me much, you know, back in to come unwound on him.
Yeah.
And I'm not the violent type person.
Yeah.
But
if somebody sat there calling you a liar and a fraud and a hoax.
Yeah, you're exactly right. But it got us thrown out of the restaurant without eating, and I sure was wanting to eat some of that coffee étouffée.
Well, sometimes pride comes before a full stomach, Calvin.
Exactly right.
Thank you for your time today. It's been an absolute pleasure to have a conversation with you. It's someone I've wanted to speak to for a very long time, Calvin. I think you're a very brave and humble man, and it's been lovely to speak with you. Where can everybody get the book from, first of all?
Amazon. The new book's name's Paspagoula, The Story Continues, New Evidence and New Witnesses, Calvin Parker.
Absolutely. And a foreword from Philip Mantle and afterword by Dr. Irina Scott.
Irene Scott, right. And I think, to be honest, I enjoyed the book. You know, I myself think it's a better book than the first one, but I'm not going to sell any of them short. Phillips worked really hard on both books.
Yeah.
But I enjoyed this book.
Mm.
Matter of fact, I'm going to order the Kindle part of it myself.
Well, I don't blame you. It's a cracking book. And I mean, it's a hefty tome as well. I mean, it's well over, it's nearly 450 pages, and I recommend it highly. It's a fascinating insight to your life and the story, and there's some fabulous clippings from when it happened and articles over the years. It's some of the information, like you referred to Philip earlier on as a bloodhound, and the evidence that he's managed to pull together is testament to that, Calvin.
You know, I didn't realize it was so much literature after I owned all this until I got to know Philip.
Mm.
And, buddy, he knows how to come up with it. All you got to do is mention it, and he'll find it.
Yeah. I mean, it must have been... I think the final point I'll make, Calvin, I think, is it must be weird when you step back into a story that essentially everybody else has been talking about you for 40 years.
It is. It really is. But it's a good feeling, too.
Good. Well, fantastic. Well, listen... Good luck with the book. I hope it continues to sell well, because I know it is doing extremely well over here in the UK. I think it's gone up to number 7 in the chart.
Yeah, I think we're number 1 Amazon. Well, the Kindle edition, and it's coming up right now in the States.
Oh, fantastic. Well, listen, all power to you. It's been lovely to speak to you. Thank you again for taking the time.
And thank you for having me and being such a great host.
Oh, well, thank you very much. You've been an excellent guest, and it's been really nice to have a proper conversation with you about everything, Calvin, and your life. And I can only wish you the best. Continue on the road to recovery, and let's hope those golden years treat you a little bit better than they have recently.
I hope so. Thank you, Paul. I appreciate it.
Very welcome. Thank you for your time. All the best, Calvin.
Thank you.